Okay, we start with three. Three bows. Okay, this is October 31st, 2009. Today Halloween?
Yes.
Maybe I should go as Mara. Today, a special class. All conditioned things are permanent. Sensual pleasures are enjoyable. And we all have a permanent, everlasting self. Listening at that point and think, what is Bhikkhu Bodhi teaching? Okay, let us begin with homage to the Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Good morning, everybody. Yeah, I had handed out this table that I had prepared some years ago. Five years ago, how quickly time goes. This shows the connections of correlations, correspondences between the fetters, the latent tendencies, and the asavas, the taints or maybe leakages. I'm not going to explain this table now because we haven't yet come to fetters or latent tendencies, but you keep this table, and I think when we come to the next sutta, sutta number 6, there we will encounter the fetters. Then when I explain the fetters, then we can look at the correlation between the fetters and the asavas. And in the later sutta, sutta number 18, we come to the, which is on the schedule, we'll come to the anusayas. Then we can see how the anusayas, the latent tendencies, fit into this picture. Okay, so now we've been studying sutta number 2 in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is the Sabhasava Sutta, the discourse on all the taints. And so far we have gotten through section number 11, and this whole section from paragraph paragraph number 5 through paragraph number 11 is concerned with the dasanena vahatva asava, the taints to be abandoned by seeing. And so these are the taints to be abandoned by seeing the Four Noble Truths, and that is the distinctive attainment of the sotapanna, the stream enterer, the disciple who has seen personally and directly the truths proclaimed by the Buddha, and by doing so has cut off the three most fundamental fetters, the fetter of personality view, it means the view of self, doubt, and wrong grasp of rules and observances. And by cutting off these three fetters, the disciple has entered what is called the stream of the Dhamma. This is the stream of the Noble Eightfold Path, which is going to carry this disciple onwards irreversibly to full liberation. Okay, now with section number 2, there's what I would call a change in emphasis introduced. If you remember, at the very beginning of the sutta, the Buddha speaks about teaching a discourse on the restraint of all the taints. That is, practices that are going to prevent the taints from accumulating, from increasing, becoming stronger, and leaking into the mind. And then he introduces the word abandoning. And we saw that there are two basic types of abandoning. One is the complete abandoning by eradication, by utterly cutting off the taints or the defilements. And as I explained in the first class on the sutta, that kind of eradication of defilements takes place through the method of seeing, that's the first of the seven methods, and the method of development, bhavana. The stage of seeing, that is the first world-transcending attainment. The attainment by which one sees into the ultimate truth of the Dhamma and thereby eradicates certain defilements right at the root level. And what is meant by development is that the cultivation of that vision of the truths, until that vision becomes so strong, clear, brilliantly bright, that it's able to completely eclipse all ignorance, which is the fundamental ground, the primordial ground of all of the other defilements. And the stage of development covers the three, or the process of development covers the three higher stages of world transcending realization. They're not mentioned separately in the sutta, but I'll just introduce the terms now. We'll explore them later in the next sutta that we take. These are the stages of the once-returner, non-returner, and arahant. Now the five methods that are sandwiched in between these two methods are concerned primarily with restraining the taints, that is, preventing them from cropping up into the mind and from gaining strength and force. And so now, with the second method, we come to what are called the taints to be abandoned by restraining. Sanvara pahatabha asava. And this method is taught specifically in the context of what is called exercising restraint over the sense faculties. Okay, so coming to the text, the Buddha says, what taints should be abandoned by restraining? Here, then he gives the answer, here a bhikkhu, a monk, reflecting wisely. This is pati sankha yoniso, reflecting carefully, thoroughly, systematically, abides with the eye faculty restrained. While taints, vexation, and fever might arise in one who abides with the eye faculty unrestrained, there are no taints, vexation, or fever in one who abides with the eye faculty restrained. Then the same thing is repeated with regard to the ear faculty, nose, tongue, body, and mind faculty. Okay, and then concluding the text says, while taints, vexation, and fever might arise in one who abides with the faculties unrestrained, there are no taints, vexation, or fever in one who abides with the faculties restrained. These are called the taints that should be abandoned by restraining. So this is a practice which other places it's called the restraint of the sense faculties. And when we look at the other passage on the restraint of the sense faculties, we have an important key to what this practice entails. We find the other passage in Sutta number 27. This is on page 274. Paragraph 15. The text says, on seeing a form with the eye, he does not grasp at the signs and features, since if he left the eye faculty unguarded, evil, or maybe bad, unwholesome states of covetousness or craving and grief or dejection might invade him. He practices the way of its restraint. He guards the eye faculty. He undertakes the restraint of the eye faculty, and so for the other senses. And so the key to this practice, as we can see from this passage, is not grasping, it's called what? Not grasping at the signs and features. The Pali text uses two technical terms here. Okay, the commentaries explain that the nimitta is what's the general, maybe the general characteristic of an object which serves as the basis for the arising of unwholesome states of mind. It can be the attractive feature of an object or the repulsive feature of the object. If it's the attractive feature of a sense object, then it serves as a base or stimulus for the arising of what's called here covetousness or craving. If it's a repulsive object, then it serves as the basis for the arising of what's called here grief, not such a satisfactory rendering. Maybe better is dejection, displeasure. And this could be understood as implying resentment, antagonism, hostility, aversion. And so often the mind just revolves back and forth between the attraction to what appears to be pleasant and enjoyable and repulsion or aversion to what is disagreeable. And so the way to overcome this sort of play of opposites in the mind is by exercising restraint over the sense faculties, not letting the mind grasp upon first the attractive and repulsive feature of the objects. So that is preventing nimittagati, the grasping of the general feature of the object. And then what's meant by anubhyanjanagahi is grasping the details of the object. And so this practice is taught especially for monastics who have to restrain the arising of any kind of sensual craving, as well as aversion due to the difficulties of living a very simple monastic life. But it can be practiced really by anybody who's intent on gaining control over the mind. Okay, the way these two work, just to give an example, this example that comes up many times in daily life. For example, say a man sees a pretty woman, there comes initially the input into the mind, the first impression, pretty woman. And then the mind grasps upon that quality of prettiness, that is nimittagahi. Then because there comes that initial stimulus, then it seems the eye of its own accord, though really with the mind behind it, but it seems almost automatically the eye starts looking, nice flowing brown hair or black hair, sparkling eyes, nice sweet smile, white teeth. So now anubhyanjanagahi then starts moving down the body, nice breasts, nice waist, nice legs, nice feet, nice toes. Wait, crooked toes? Pigeon toes? And so now turning away from the attractive object to something repulsive, then starts looking back up at the face again. Wait, that nose is not so pretty. Big nose, crooked nose. Then the interest fades away. Okay, anyway, this is how the grasping of a pleasant object can take place. Then the grasping of painful objects, or disagreeable objects. This is an interesting phenomenon of the mind. What I've found, sometimes the mind will settle upon something which can be rather trifling, just very slightly annoying, and yet that comes to obsess the mind. I remember back many years ago when I started to meditate. This is when I was in graduate school, living in the residence hall at Claremont Graduate School. It seemed that whenever I sat to meditate, a dog about two blocks away would start barking. And you know, it was just like a faint sound coming from the distance, but the mind would always settle on that dog, which somehow would start to bark as soon as I sat down. You know, I might be studying maybe from 7:30 to 9 o'clock, dog is quiet. 9 o'clock, I get my seat ready, sit down, cross my legs, settle in breath, out breath, in breath, bark, out breath, in breath, out breath, in breath, out breath. This went on night after night till I decided, you know, this was a graduate residence hall. There were students in the other rooms, sometimes talking, maybe watching television. You know, you get the sound of the television. Didn't bother me. But just one dog barking 2 blocks away, that's what the ear is picking up. And so what I did finally, I have to go to the people who own that dog and explain to them that I'm trying to meditate. At least they could be kind and understanding and put a muzzle on the dog so it wouldn't disturb my meditation. And so I would leave the residence hall, go walking down 2 blocks to the corner. The dog is still barking, woof, woof. But I get to the corner and the dog is quiet. So which house is it? Should I go to every house on the block? Do you happen to have a dog that was barking 2 minutes ago? But then I thought the people are going to think I'm crazy. So I turn back, go back to the residence hall. Everything is quiet. The dog has stopped barking. I can go back to my meditation, take the seat, cross the legs, in breath, out breath. I've succeeded. Dog is quiet. In breath, out breath. Wow, that really works. I just have to walk to the corner and the dog will stop. In breath. Out breath. Woof, woof, woof. So this is picking up, this is called the patika nimitta, the repulsive object, disagreeable object. The patika nimitta. And then even though one is trying to keep the mind on the breath, one starts picking up all of the details in that barking of the dog, even from the very beginning of the woof, the roughing, the rough sound of the woof, the amount of time between one woof and another, all of those details become clear. Okay, so this is the way the mind picks up the features of disagreeable objects. And so what one has to do here, well, there are different ways to deal with this. One way, of course, is to just try not to pay attention to that disagreeable object and just go back to the main meditation object, in-breath, out-breath, in-breath, out-breath. But I found after some time that this didn't work so successfully. And so what I found to be a useful method, I picked this up in a book on mindfulness practice called The Heart of Buddhist Meditation. What I found is the useful method is to turn the attention to the object itself and to the mind's reaction to the object. So one just listens to the barking sound of the dog, just listening to sheer sound, not evaluating it as something interrupting my meditation, not something being done with malicious intent to disturb my meditation, but just, this is the play of conditions. People have dogs in the neighborhood. Dogs bark, that's the sound of a barking dog. In fact, you could even suspend the idea of a dog barking, and it's just the sound, a bare sound. And then one can note how the sound takes place, how the mind catches onto the sound, even almost obstinately fastening on the sound, and then how annoyance and irritation arise based on that sound. And one just watches the sound, watches the act of hearing, watches the irritation that arises. And then one is practicing, it's actually part of the fourth satipatthana, the attention to he knows the sound, he knows the ear, and he knows the fetter that arises on both. So in this way, something that's irritating can be transformed into something which is a basis for insight and understanding. Okay, and then after one starts attending to the sound for some time in this way, then it loses its disagreeable tone and it just becomes part of the background. And so it falls off into the background and then one can go back to the in and out breathing. Okay, so now the Buddha speaks here in the Savasava Sutta. He says that it's through reflecting wisely, this is important, that one dwells with the sense faculties restrained. So one reflects wisely, one reflects on the advantages, first one reflects on the disadvantages of letting the senses run at random to their sense objects. The disadvantages of being caught up in this whirlpool of attachment to the pleasant, repulsion and aversion towards the unpleasant, and reflects on the benefits of being free from this whirlwind of subjugation to sense objects, the self-mastery, the peacefulness, the ability to dwell happily under all conditions. And then one exercises restraint of the senses by not letting the senses become fastened upon the sign, the nimitta, of what is attractive and repulsive, and then become engaged or engrossed in the details of what is attractive and repulsive. And one, when one does that, then the text says, taints, vexation, and fever that might arise in one who doesn't dwell with the senses restraint. While taints, vexation, and fever might arise in one who dwells with the faculties unrestrained, there are no taints, vexation, or fever in one who abides with the faculties restrained. Here the text uses three words, and this is somewhat interesting, almost as if they're synonymous. Along with the word asava, which is translated in the sutta as taints, but now I think I prefer leakages, They're also, and the word asava is suggests the idea of a liquid flowing. But now we have two other words, vigata. Vigata is based on a root han, which means to strike, to hit. And then the V, the prefix V, intensifies that. So it's something which strikes or hits at the mind. So I render it here as vexation, or it can be also be rendered distress. And then the other word is parilaha, which comes from a root which means burning. And the word parilaha, it's often used to indicate a fever, like when one gets ill. But here it's not referring to a bodily illness, but it's the fever of the mental defilements, considered as burning the mind. And so we have actually three images given here, or underlying these words, three metaphors. One is that of a stream flowing into the mind, or water seeping through into the mind, leakage or seepage into the mind. The second image is of striking or hitting, and the third image is of burning. And it seems to me, this is my personal conjecture, that the word, in this passage, the word asava, or taint, is not being used so much in the technical sense of the three asavas of sensuality, craving for existence, and ignorance, but it's being used in a more general sense of any kind of defilement, including both sensual craving as well as ill will, disturbance, aversion, distress. Okay, and so when one dwells with the senses restraint, then those asavas don't get a chance to flow into the mind. The sense restraint, of course, doesn't eradicate the asavas, but it prevents them from gaining momentum and overwhelming the mind. Okay, maybe I'll ask whether there's any questions on this passage. And they should be pertinent questions, I mean, things that have to be cleared up.
With respect to the last thing you said, it may be just inability to practice well, but if a sensation or a feeling or something is so strong,
yeah,
penetrating it somehow enhances it rather than lets it dissipate. It intensifies, let's say, very severe pain, a very strong emotion.
Yeah.
Examination of it does not let it open, it just makes it stronger.
Yeah.
Then what path does one take? You don't have the skillful means to examine a very strong sensation the way you described.
Mm-hmm. Maybe can you repeat the question again? Just one phrase that you said, I didn't catch it because...
Right, let's, for example, a strong emotion like, yeah, fear or,
yeah,
jealousy that's so overpowering that examination using these skillful means,
yeah,
doesn't work.
Okay.
Then what path to take?
Okay, when a very strong emotion like this arises, the way that I suggest is to examine, actually not to be afraid of it and not to try to push it away, but just to look at it as a mental state and watch the mind in that state. Because one can never, when one puts oneself in the position of the observer of the mental state, one creates a certain distance between oneself, or let's say between one part of the mind and that mental state. So you just are regarding this as a state that's arising in the mind. One recognizes that this state has arisen through certain conditions, even if it's very strong and overpowering, just watch the mental state. And one finds that if one does this repeatedly over time, one gets a certain peacefulness, even while that mental state is present simultaneously. So one is just pure, taking the position of a pure observer of the mental state. So it becomes almost as if, even though that mental state is, we would say, your own, but it's almost as if you're watching a movie where somebody is maybe the hero, a heroine, is pushed to the edge of a cliff, like one of these Alfred Hitchcock movies where the hero is hanging from the cliff by one hand and looks down below. There's, you know, he's from the hanging from Mount Fillmore, is it?
Rushmore,
looking down. Or from the top of a skyscraper, holding to the windowsill, looking down. So you're looking at that mental state just the way you might be looking at the hero in this Alfred Hitchcock movie. You know, you could recognize the fear in the mind of that hero, partly you're identifying with the hero, but you know it's just a movie. And so in a way, you know that your mind is, in a way, I don't want to say it's nothing more than a movie, but that this is just a changing scene within the flow of the mind. And then as one repeatedly watches the state of mind in this way and develops that ability to stand back from it and just identify what's occurring in the mind, gradually it's weakening the roots of that state of mind, depriving it of strength. Whereas if one pushes it away and refuses to look at it, that enables that state of mind to gather strength below the surface. And so it will continually come up and taunt you and haunt you.
Thank you.
Okay, but I pretty much want to keep the questions based just on the text itself. So if is the question actually directly related to the text?
Well,
okay, then take the microphone. Okay. It's a good thing that you've asked somebody who in graduate school took courses in phenomenology, otherwise they wouldn't know what's meant by bracket. I would say that there's, to some extent, that's involved here, but there's a difference in the underlying motive between a person who's undertaking the practice of sense restraint here and somebody who's taking the purely phenomenological approach of Husserl's bracketing. What I would say, Husserl's bracketing comes closer to what is involved in aspects of the Satipatthana practice, that is the practice of the full mindfulness meditation. At this point with the sense restraint, we've not yet come into the full practice of the mindfulness meditation. This is sort of what I would call a preparatory practice. And the basic aim here, it's not like Husserl's phenomenology to get an understanding of the essences of things, the nature of things themselves. But here the object is to prevent the arising of what are called the taints, vexations, and fever. Okay, I think we should go on now to the next section. And this is a section, it's explained in terms of the practice of a monastic person, but it can be applied in its own way to anybody in any station of life. Here the Buddha is speaking about how a monk should use what are called the four requisites. In Buddhism, in Pali, we call these four paccaya. These are the four supporting conditions of life. And the four supporting conditions are the robe, alms food, the dwelling place, and medicinal requisites. And so the Buddha, of course, since he's teaching monks, he explains this in terms of the lifestyle of the monk. So he says, what taints should be abandoned by using? Here, a bhikkhu, a monk, reflecting wisely, uses the robe only for protection from cold, for protection from heat, for protection from contact with gadflies, mosquitoes, wind, the hot sun, and creeping things like insects and snakes, and only for the purpose of concealing the private parts. Okay, so this is explained the way the monk uses the robe. So generally the monks will have three robes with maybe a change of the upper and under robe for when washing the other robes. But one could apply this even in the household life for the use of clothes. So if you consider clothing in this way, you don't always have to be buying the latest high fashion clothing. Just the other day, somebody was telling me that, a woman was telling me that there are these dresses, Saint Laurent and Gucci dresses, that go for like $100,000. I hope I don't trouble anybody by saying this, but why? So that you can go to these high fashion cocktail parties and show I'm with the label Gucci, Saint Laurent, and show I'm able to spend $100,000 on a dress, when one could buy dresses that will save the same purpose for much less. Okay, similarly with men's clothing. So if one reflects wisely, you don't have to have a whole wardrobe filled with many fancy, variegated clothing. It doesn't mean that you have to, you know, dress like an utter, do you call this, a person who's completely outside the trends of fashion. Is there a special term for that?
Frumpy.
What is that?
Frumpy.
I'm not catching it.
Frumpy.
Crumby.
Frumpy.
Yeah. So I mean, you can wear nice clothing, which is, you know, somewhat in fashion, but you don't really need so many clothes. And try to live very simply, frugally. Okay, then reflecting wisely, he uses the alms food neither for amusement nor for intoxication. What's meant by intoxication is just to enjoy a lot of different tastes, nor for the sake of physical beauty and attractiveness. This was an idea in India, in the Buddha's time, maybe even today, that physical attractiveness is seen in plumpness. You know, now we have the ideal that, especially that women should be thin and men should be relatively thin but muscular. But in India, in the Buddha's time, the ideal was that both men and women should be plump. And so people would eat a lot and eat fattening foods in order to fatten themselves up. So one eats not for the sake of physical beauty and attractiveness, but only for the endurance and continuation of this body, for ending discomfort, and for assisting, supporting the holy life, reflecting, thus I shall terminate old feelings, that is the old feeling of hunger, the pain of hunger, without arousing new feelings, that is the pain that comes from eating too much and then feeling discomfort, and then maybe the pain also of the illnesses that come from overeating. And I shall be healthy and blameless and shall live in comfort. Again, this is wise advice for anybody to follow, especially now today when we know that eating in excess and eating the wrong types of food leads to obesity, to various illnesses like heart conditions, strokes, heart attacks, diabetes, and other conditions. Okay, and so it doesn't mean that one should avoid delicious food and just cook completely bland food. Though if anybody wants to taste bland food, I will be willing to cook for them. But one should know the proper measure in eating. Eat the right amount to keep oneself strong and healthy without overeating so that one becomes overweight. And one should eat the nutritious food that will support one's body and enable one to fulfill one's duties and to continue your Dhamma practice. Okay, then the third requisite for support is the dwelling place. So here the text says, again, reflecting wisely, he uses the resting place or dwelling place only for protection from cold, for protection from heat, for protection from contact with flies, mosquitoes, wind, the hot sun, and creeping things, and only for the purpose of warding off the perils of climate. Again, that's the rain, snow, wind, and for enjoying retreat, for solitary meditation. And then the fourth requisite is medicines. In the Buddha's time, they didn't have very expensive prescription medications, no high-cost hospitals, high-cost insurance policies, but basically people used herbal medicines, and so they would provide herbal medicines to the monks, as well as certain refreshments which are allowable after 12 noon, things like honey, sugar, they would use the sugar from actual sugar cane, and drinks, allowable drinks. So those are considered medicines as well. So reflecting wisely, he uses the medicinal requisites only for protection from arisen afflicting feelings, from the pain of illness, and for the benefit of good health. Okay, so again, we have the same concluding paragraph. While taints, vexation, and fever might arise in one who does not use the requisites in this way, there are no such taints, vexation, or fever in one who uses them thus. So those are called the taints that should be abandoned by using. Okay, now I'll go directly into the next. I'll try to get through at least through the number six, then I'll ask for questions. Okay, now we come to taints that should be abandoned by enduring. By enduring, what is being indicated here is patience, things that one has to endure with patience. And so this was especially necessary in leading the monastic life during the time of the Buddha, when usually for 8 months of the year, the monks would wander without any kind of fixed dwelling place. They would live out in the open. They would have to walk from town to town, village to village, all over northern India, sometimes exposed to very hot, sunny weather. Sometimes during the rainy season, they would have to remain indoors most of the time. But at other times, there could be sudden showers to which they're exposed. Sometimes strong winds. One would always be exposed to flies, biting flies, mosquitoes, ants, and so on. And so the text says, reflecting wisely, the monk bears cold and heat. Some months in India would be very hot, like March, April, May, the hottest months, then cold months relatively to India. This would be December, January, February are the cold months. Hunger and thirst. Usually the monks would go on alms round. Sometimes if they come to an area which is hostile to Buddhism, they might not receive any offerings of food, and so they might have to endure hunger for the day or even several days. Thirst, sometimes one would be walking long distances, no opportunity to refill one's water bottles. Contact with flies, mosquitoes, wind, the sun, and creeping things. Again, insects, snakes, ants, leeches. Do you know what leeches are like? Some of you do. We used to have them all over in the places where I was living in Sri Lanka. There are these little... You don't want me to describe what they're like. Oh, they're lots of fun. They're like worms, except worms just remain passively on the ground. But the leeches hide under leaves. And when they can sense a human body approaching, and they raise their heads up under the leaves like this. And when the foot, and usually we walk either barefoot through the forest or wearing just the rubber thongs, not with socks and shoes. And so when they sense the human being approaching, they latch onto the foot and then they creep up in between the toes. Usually one doesn't feel them at first until maybe at some point, especially when one arrives at one's destination, one sits down in the chair, one will feel a little annoying sensation. It could be between the toes, or usually between the toes. Sometimes they climb up the leg. Sometimes even going as far up to this, the crotch. And then one feels a little annoying sensation there. And then one looks under the toes or on one's leg, and one sees a stream of blood. And then if one looks carefully, one might see, could be a few inches away from you, even a foot, there'll be something which is now swollen and fat, like a real fat worm, creeping away like an inchworm. And sometimes they're almost a little bit like a suicide bomb. The enjoyment of drinking the blood is enough of a reward for them to risk suicide, so that they get crushed between the toe and the shoe or the thong that you're wearing. And so when you take off your thong or sandal, you'll find a mass of blood on it, with the skin, the broken skin of the leech. Okay, so these are some of the things one has to endure. Okay, but there are not only these different types of creeping things, but there is also ill-spoken, unwelcome words. In India during the Buddha's time, the people, not all of the people, were respectful of the Buddhist monastics, but sometimes there would be communities which were following one of the other religious groups which were quite hostile to the Buddhists. Sometimes the Brahmins would abuse and revile the Buddhists, calling them shaven-headed, good-for-nothings, baldies, waste parasites on society, outcasts, and so on. someone would get these ill-spoken, unwelcome words. And nowadays, it's common experience to be spoken to in this way. Everybody has that. And then come the arisen bodily feelings from illness, from travel, the natural pains of the body. Feelings arise that are painful, racking, sharp, piercing, disagreeable, distressing, menacing to life. And so one has to be able to endure those pains with patience. Okay, then come the taints to be abandoned by avoiding. This is basically prescription for good common sense. So here, reflecting wisely, the monk avoids a wild elephant, a wild horse, a wild bull, a wild dog, a snake, a stump. This would be the stump of a tree which has fallen down, a bramble patch, a chasm, a cliff, a cesspit, a sewer. Reflecting wisely, he avoids sitting on unsuitable seats. These would be sitting together with people that could harm his reputation. Wandering to unsuitable resorts. It would be parts of the city or town which would be the equivalent of what we now call the red light districts. And so the monk should not go walking alone to those areas, because then people, when he starts coming back, people will see him and say, what was that monk doing in the red light district? And associating with bad friends, since if he were to do so, then his wise companions would suspect him of improper conduct. Okay, so these, and then if one acts in this way, then certain taints, vexation, and fever could arise. So these are the taints to be abandoned by avoiding. Then we come to number 6. These are the taints to be abandoned by removing. Or I think a better translation here is dispelling. This is applying methods of dispelling unwholesome thoughts. So what are the taints that should be abandoned by removing or dispelling? Here, reflecting wisely, the monk does not tolerate an arisen thought of sensual desire. He abandons it, removes it, does away with it, and annihilates it or obliterates it. He does not tolerate an arisen thought of ill will. He does not tolerate an arisen thought of cruelty. These are taken to be the 3 primary types of what are called wrong thought or unwholesome thoughts. Thought of sensual desire, which is rooted in craving or greed. And then thoughts of ill will and thoughts of cruelty, which are rooted in hatred. And so in training the mind, one has to eliminate these unwholesome thoughts. When we come to a later sutta, we're going to see some of the specific methods that the Buddha taught for overcoming and eliminating these unwholesome thoughts. Here, if we just read this text the way it's been recorded, it seems as though the text is prescribing a kind of rather forceful and aggressive method of tackling unwholesome thoughts. But as we will see, the Buddhist texts actually recommend a variety of strategies. Some methods are soft and gentle, other methods are rather forceful. So we could say that the aim is to overcome and dispel these unwholesome thoughts, but the methods themselves are not necessarily forceful and aggressive. Sometimes the best method of overcoming these unwholesome thoughts, it's a little bit like the judo method. You know, in judo, they say, I've never practiced judo, but The master of judo doesn't use his own bodily strength and force to overcome his opponent, but he lets the opponent attack, and then he bends and yields, seeming to yield, in order to allow the opponent to defeat himself by drawing the strength of the opponent and using that to the opponent's disadvantage so that he overcomes his opponent. Has anybody practiced judo?
That's like Tai Chi.
Oh, Tai Chi does that.
Tai Chi, same thing. You let it go right in the wall.
Okay, so some methods are like Tai Chi or judo. That's like the method I explained before. Instead of just trying to directly confront and combat the unwholesome thought, one can just stand by and watch it, not yielding to it, not grasping the thought and allowing it to proliferate, but just by watching it, it exhausts its own strength and then fades away. But I don't want at this point to go into the specific method, since we're going to deal with that in relation to a later sutta. Okay, now these with taints to be abandoned by removing, this is the last section on what I call provisional methods of abandoning the taints, or methods of actually restraining the taints so that they don't gain power. And so at this point, I'll ask whether anybody has any questions on the sections from taints to be abandoned by using up to taints to be abandoned by removing or dispelling. Okay, this is actually a comment from somebody who's following on the internet, but it's actually an interesting comment. He says, using focuses on tendencies to craving and grasping pleasant things. Actually, that's true, because one tends to have a craving for clothing, delicious food, luxurious dwelling places. Well, I don't know whether anybody has craving for medicines, but okay, but the first three certainly can be bases for craving. And then he says, enduring, that is in passage, paragraph number 18, focuses on unpleasant things that create aversion and ill will. He says, was this the main intention of those two practices? It's not stated that way explicitly, but I think this brings out the underlying intention of them. So that's quite a good point. Okay. Any questions on any of these sections? Oh, wait.
Are taints to be abandoned by using part of taints to be abandoned by restraining
taint? I didn't quite catch the question. Speak more loudly.
Can taints to be abandoned
by using
considered as part of taints to be abandoned by restraining?
Okay, this is that's a good point. Yeah, actually that's an interesting point, that there's some aspect of restraining involved in using, even though they're counted separately. But when one uses these things like the clothing, food, dwelling place, one has to restrain, you know, the sensory attachment to robes, can't be very fancy, but clothing, one has a kind of craving for beautiful, attractive clothing. Well, even there are some types of, I have to tell you, sometimes like monks have obsession with robes of a particular color. Like, I want the mahogany colored robe. I don't want a robe which is sort of a little bit orange colored like this. And so if somebody offers a robe which is a little sort of a brownish orange, no, I don't want this. I put it away and tried to trade it with another monk to get the mahogany colored. Or else the story about the alms bowl. There's a little bit of a diversion, but I'll tell it. Yeah, you see, my early years in Sri Lanka, we were all using the Sri Lankan bowls, which are black bowls made out of I don't know what kind of metal, but nothing very attractive. Then some monks had gone to Thailand and came from Thailand back to Sri Lanka with these bright, shiny, stainless steel alms bowls. And you know, when there's a line of monks in the dining hall, all of the monks are sitting there with their ordinary black, they call this process. They take the bowl, they put oil over it, sesame oil, and then they put it in a fire to glaze it with a coating of burnt sesame oil to protect the metal. Yeah, so that's the Sri Lankan bowl. Then one monk who's been to Thailand comes, sits down maybe at the end of the line with his bright, beautiful stainless steel bowl. And then all the eyes go. And then Monk B thinks, I have to go to Thailand. And he goes to Thailand and comes back with a bright, beautiful stainless bowl. And then nobody is satisfied with their black, glazed, ordinary Sri Lankan made bowls. And so now it's hard to find the old style Sri Lankan bowls in Sri Lanka. Everybody has the Thai style bowl. Okay, so one gets the craving for the beautiful things. And those are also things that one uses based on sensory impressions. So there is some degree of sense restraint involved in that. But probably because the things that are used are so prominent in one's day-to-day life that they're put into a separate category. Okay, this comes... Okay, we'll take the question from... I'll take that one question, then I'll have to go on because I want to finish the sutta today.
It seems like many things persist because one gives attention to them.
Because one gets?
One gives attention to
them. One gives attention to them,
yes.
Right.
And we think, in terms of particle physics,
yeah.
Things come into being by merely being observed.
Yeah.
On this minute level, and they don't exist if one isn't observing them.
Yeah, yeah.
At the same time, with observing one's obsession,
yeah,
with an object or an irritation or whatever, creates somewhat of a dilemma. Because if one is focusing attention on it, then it exists.
Yeah.
But if one is not giving it attention, it doesn't exist.
Yeah. Okay, that's an interesting point, but I think that point will become more relevant later on when we deal with the method of removing the unwholesome thoughts. Okay, this is a question. Since the Buddha singled out medicine and using under the category of using, can we infer that there was herbal drug abuse by monks even in the Buddha's days? No, I wouldn't say that that's the case, but what's meant by medicinal requisites here, it sometimes is given a broader meaning to include things that one is entitled to use for refreshment after midday. Midday is the cutoff point for the meal, and so one can take proper food after midday, but there are things which the Buddha made allowable, like I said before, honey, oil, butter, and then something is called pani tang. This is like palm sugar, the sugar of the palm tree, which is taken as a kind of liquid, then it's crystallized, so it becomes, or it solidifies, so it becomes a kind of block of hard sugar, which is very delicious because it has the sap of the palm tree. And so these are things which, again, they can become objects of attachment and craving, especially if one starts storing up large quantities of them. Okay, then I'll just take this one last question from the internet, then I'll move on and finish the sutta. He says, some of the Thai forest monks go to live alone in the remote areas where there are wild tigers, and they meditate at the edge of tall cliffs to overcome fear. Aren't these against the advice on avoiding here in the sutta? I have to say that seems to me to be the case. Okay, like some of the monks from the Thai forest tradition, if you read the biography of Achan Mun and the way of practice of the Dhammaduta monks in Thailand, the ascetic monks, they're encouraged to go out into the wild to meditate in areas where tigers are living, wild elephants, and probably many of them get killed in that environment. But this is their way of sort of testing their fortitude, testing their courage, trying to enter into a battle with fear by going to these fearful places. It seems to me that it's not written that this practice, while I can admire those who do this for their courage, their determination, but it doesn't seem to me to be in accordance with the spirit of the Buddha's middle way, which is indicated by the passage on avoiding. That's my personal opinion. Okay, I want to go to the last major section of the sutta. These are the taints to be abandoned by developing. So as we're going to see, what is meant here by developing is developing the seven factors of enlightenment. So the text says, here a bhikkhu reflecting wisely develops the mindfulness enlightenment factor, which is supported by seclusion, dispassion, and cessation, and ripens in or matures in relinquishment. He develops the investigation of states, investigation of phenomena, enlightenment factor. The energy enlightenment factor, the rapture enlightenment factor, the tranquility enlightenment factor, the concentration enlightenment factor, the equanimity enlightenment factor, supported by seclusion, dispassion, and cessation, and ripening in relinquishment. Okay, when we see the enlightenment factors described in connection with this additional phrase, supported by seclusion, dispassion, and cessation, ripening and relinquishment, this seems to me to suggest that this is a fairly high level in the development of the enlightenment factors, a level at which the enlightenment factors have reached a fair degree of maturity. Because supported by seclusion means that one is now secluding oneself from the defilements of the mind. One is able to overcome, at least temporarily, the pull and the impulsive force of craving and aversion. And one is moving towards dispassion, the ending of attachment. One is moving towards cessation, the cessation of all defilements and all of conditioned existence. And this enlightenment factor has gained such power that it's ready to ripen in relinquishment, the letting go of all attachment. And so we have these enlightenment factors, seven enlightenment factors, unfolding first with mindfulness as the starting point. The way I understand it, one begins with the four foundations of mindfulness, the four establishments of mindfulness. On this basis, one starts to investigate the qualities of the mind, to distinguish what is unwholesome, what is wholesome, removing the unwholesome, strengthening the wholesome. As one strengthens the wholesome factors, energy increases, the determination to sustain the practice. As that energy increases and the mind settles down, it brings a swelling up of joy or rapture, piti. Initially, rapture, though it's uplifting, blissful, delightful, but it involves a certain, what I call a certain element of disturbance, because there's exhilaration and excitement to it. But as one continues to develop the foundations of mindfulness, the rapture settles down, then the mind enters the state of tranquility. When the mind becomes tranquil, this facilitates the move towards concentration. When concentration matures, it brings equanimity. And then when these seven enlightenment factors are present together, with the equanimity as the culmination, then one renews the investigation enlightenment factor, and that brings the arising of panya, wisdom or insight. And when that wisdom of insight comes to maturity, then it will eradicate successively the fetters, the latent tendencies, and the taints. And so that's how the development of the seven factors of enlightenment leads to the three higher stages of realization, culminating in the end of all of the defilements. And so now, concluding the discourse, the Buddha says in the last paragraph, when for a bhikkhu, a monk, the taints that should be abandoned by seeing have been abandoned by seeing, when the taints that should be abandoned by restraining have been abandoned by restraining, so for the taints that should be abandoned by using, taints that should be abandoned by enduring, taints that should be abandoned by avoiding, taints that should be abandoned by removing, when the taints that should be abandoned by developing have been abandoning by developing, then he is called a monk who dwells restrained with the restraint of all the taints. He has severed craving, flung off the fetters, and with the complete penetration of conceit, he has made an end of suffering. Okay, and so that takes us to the end of the discourse. If there's any questions, we could just maybe take one or two questions and then come back after the meal for the question period. Any questions? This gentleman.
I'd like to know if I'm receiving this.
Okay, please use the microphone.
Yeah. It seems to me that in a lot of the definitions of things, so which things are to be, you know, dealt with in which ways. But he tends to define them by their effects rather than by their what they are, which is a. And I have a hard time telling which kinds of things are supposed to be handled in which ways.
I see.
There's very little. There's little energy in the text in what the things are.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. It seems that the emphasis here is on, you mean that each section deals with the methods rather than the particular. I think maybe we could see this as some indication of, I just have to conjecture an answer. Maybe this can be seen as an indication of the pragmatic approach of the Buddha's teaching, that the Buddha's concerned with indicating the methods, and the practitioners will know for themselves what are the particular taints, vexations, and fevers that are to be eliminated by these methods. Or it could be the case simply that it was part of like the renunciate culture during the time of the Buddha, that in whatever ascetic community one was practicing, one had a pretty good idea already of what are the factors to be eliminated by the training. And so one knows what one has to overcome, but what is needed are the methods for removing these particular unwholesome mental states. But there are enough suttas in which the Buddha does explain the unwholesome mental states to be eliminated. And we will come to them as we go along. And so it could be that the case that we just can't take one sutta in isolation as though it were the entirety of the Buddha's teaching. But no doubt, monks during the Buddha's time, whether monks, lay people, they would have been exposed again and again to different teachings of the Buddha. So they're a little bit like pieces of a jigsaw puzzle that one just has to put together in order to get the whole picture. Okay, I'll just take this internet question, then we'll do the dedication of merit. And then if anybody has any further questions, please come back at 12 o'clock. Okay, the question, it seems that seeing, that's the practice of seeing and the method of developing, require sitting meditation, whereas restraining, using, and removing of practices in everyday activities. Is this correct? I'd say it's more or less correct, except that when we speak about developing the seven factors of enlightenment, certainly a large part of the practice will be sitting meditation, but there's also interwoven with sitting meditation, there's also the walking meditation. And so, in fact, some practitioners will give more emphasis to walking meditation, some more emphasis to sitting meditation. But what we can say is that seeing and developing generally occur through a deliberate training in meditation, whereas restraining, using, removing, and so on are broader extensions of the meditative frame of mind to activities in everyday life. Okay, so this will be the class for this morning. I should mention today is October 31st. We won't have a class next Sunday, but the next class will be on November 14th. And that class we will take Sutta number 6. This is called If a Bhikkhu Should Wish. And this sutta will take us in through the four stages of realization, as well as some of the other advanced attainments along the path of practice. And then this will be followed by sutta number 7. I believe Sutta 6 and 7, Kaidi, are already on the BAUS website. So if any of you don't have the textbook, it's now been reissued by Wisdom Publications. I think just this week it came back into print. But if you don't have the textbook and you want to follow the sutta, you can download it off the Baus website. Even if you have the textbook, if you don't want to carry this heavy weight back and forth, you can just print out those pages and bring them to the class. Okay, so please remember that will be November 14th, 9:30. We will have the meditation, 9:30 to 10. And please try to come exactly on time or even a little bit early, because when people start to sit and then the door constantly opens, closes, the creaking sound, it's a little bit like a dog barking. Okay, we'll end with the sharing of the merits. I'll do it in the short style. Akasata Jabumata Deva Naga Mahitika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Sasanam Akasata Jabumata Deva Naga Mahitika Punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu desanam akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu mang parang etavata cham hehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe devanumodantu Sabbe bhutanumodantu, sabbe satanumodantu, sabba sampati siddhya, bhavagupadhaya vichihetato, etantare satakayupapanna, rupi arupicha, asanya sanino, dukkha pamuchantu, Pusantu Nibhutin. Okay, we end with the three bones.